Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. Okay, we are in paper 57, right at the very beginning, which is old single column, page 651. And we are also obviously right at the very beginning of part 3. Of the fifth epical revelation to mankind. And so this part is entitled The History of Urantia. And I just want to note up front, you know, we just finished part 2. Remember you had a revelatory commission of local universe personalities. Remember how we... You know, that they mentioned that again at the very end of the last paper there in part 2, how you have 12 individuals, you know, that are working under the authorization of Gabriel, 12 local universe personalities that are behind, you know, were behind all of part 2, but they... brought in a lot of, you know, additional people beyond the 12 to help out with, you know, many of the papers. Same is true here. It's the same commission of 12, headed by Mantush and Melchizedek, that's behind part 3. Same revelatory commission. You know, they wrapped up part 2 in 1934. They wrapped up part 3 in 1935. And like I just said, I mean, they very much do that similar thing where they go beyond those 12 for actual authors. And we start out with a block of 9 papers here at the beginning of part 3, that are about the evolution of life. And those 9 papers are authored by one of the life carriers that's still on our planet. Those original life carriers that were behind the initiating and the fostering of life on our world. You know, we could even go back and remind ourselves, you don't have to turn there, I'll just remind you that back when we were reading the Life Carrier paper, paper 36, they, you know, they said upon the arrival of a planetary prince, they, the life carriers, prepare to leave. Though 2 of the senior carriers and 12 custodians may volunteer by taking temporary renunciation vows to remain indefinitely on the planet as advisors in the matter of the further development and conservation of the life plasm. 2 such sons and their 12 associates are now serving on Urantia. Now, we don't know for certain, you know, which of those 14, but one would probably assume first that it's one of those 2. That was given the task, you know, and probably one of those 2 was heading the group, you know, of life carriers originally. And it may very well be that head that authored these papers about the evolution of life. So, you know, there is no greater authority. He very much knows of that which he speaks. They literally designed a life on this planet. You know, it just really speaks to that issue of the authoritative elimination of error. That you have this incredible gift that's been given to us, that those that aren't groping in the dark like we are trying to figure out how everything works, those that know very directly have given us the framework that we need, that's solid, and within which we can then pursue the details in true form. They don't unpack all the details of the paleontology of this planet and whatnot. That's our job. But they give us the proper initial assumptions, the reference points that allow us to be able to eventually do that on our own in a solid fashion and clear up the unresolvable conundrums that we currently are trapped in. Okay, so you can see this first paper, paper 57, says it's entitled "The Origin of Urantia," and for those of you who know the Revelation well, when they say origin, boy, do they mean origin. They're going to start with the force charge of space, go to automatons, right, all the way forward. So long, long before there was a sun, that there could be a planet named Urantia going around, they're going to get everything in play. Like I said, literally starting with the force charge of space. Starting with that, which is pre-energy. So those are serious origins. Just think about how amazing that is, that that we can contemplate the origin of this world in such a deep, holistic context like that. And how
it isn't 14 billion years.
Yeah, you're jumping ahead again. All right, we'll get to that issue in just a minute, yes. And we'll see very quickly that... when you have the actual story, when you have the reality instead of our the current appearances that the scientists are laboring under, it's a very grand and different story than is currently believed. Okay, so let's, I think enough said up front, let's jump in. Why don't you read both paragraphs of that preface first here, and we'll talk about these initial issues.
Part 3, The History of Urantia. Paper 57, The Origin of Urantia. In presenting excerpts from the archives of Gerasim for the records of Urantia respecting its antecedents and early history, we are directed to reckon time in terms of current usage. The present leap year calendar of 365 1/4 days to the year. As a rule, no attempt will be made to give exact years, though they are of record. We will use the nearest whole numbers as the better method of presenting these historic facts. When referring to an event as of 1 or 2 millions of years ago, we intend to date such an occurrence back that number of years from the early decades of the 20th century of the Christian era. We will thus depict these far distant events as occurring in even periods of thousands, millions, and billions of years.
Okay, so just giving you some just a little basic framework. You saw how in that first sentence, its antecedents. Like I said, boy, when they say antecedents, they mean antecedents. Now, when they say the present leap year calendar, in other words, the Gregorian calendar, not the Julian calendar. And going, well, if you're familiar with those details, when you see 365 1/4, you go, well, technically, exactly 365 1/4, that's the Julian calendar, not the Gregorian calendar. The Gregorian calendar is 365.2425, right? Because not every, 4 years is a leap year in the Gregorian calendar like it was in the Julian. Right? What's the deal there? You might notice that they didn't put 365.25. They purposely put a quarter. Right? As they go through this whole story, as you could kind of see from that next sentence, they're not going to give, extremely precise. They're accurate, right? But they're not precise, very precise numbers. Because that would be giving us too much, right? Except for a couple examples that you'll see right here as we start reading, I mean, you basically only have two significant digits in these numbers, right? You know, so the difference between 365.25 and 0.2425 is not relevant, right? When you're, you know, and most of the time it isn't even, you know, precisely two significant digits. I mean, you know, it's not to the nearest one, it's to the nearest five, you know, a lot of times, right? When they're just giving you those two digits. Right, so it's just a, you know, an approximate but accurate date, right? And certainly as we get deeper into this, you know, we'll greatly appreciate how significant that is to have these accurate dates. Right, so there's that. And, you know, and you can also see that issue in that second paragraph. And it's like, well, is it so many million years back from 1934? Or, okay, it doesn't matter. Right? Anywhere in that ballpark, because we're, yeah. You know, you're lucky if you can, you know, if they're giving you a date that's, you know, plus or minus 1,000 years, right? I mean, they're going through, you know, not to mention, you know, plus or minus billions and billions of years. It doesn't matter, you know, which year at the beginning of the 20th century you're talking about. Right. See, so again, just that spirit of giving us accurate but indeed, you know, just approximate dates. And let's see, anything else there?
What they say, presenting these historic facts.
Yes.
Because earlier on they say historic facts will stand on the records of time in a revelation. But a lot of times the cosmology that we can't predict what's happening in the future.
Right. Again,
so
you know,
the history part is real. There's,
you know, giving us, you know, using our model of the nucleus, you know, to try to give us some hints about things. Right? You don't have that so much. You know, they're just giving you the date. Okay, it's not a model. It's just the date. And like they said, I mean, they could give it to you, you know, down to the second if they wanted to. Right. They could certainly tell you the exact year prior to 1934, say, or whatever, right? That's, you know, not only is that not appropriate to a revelation, you know, as an over-revealing, I mean, technically, you know, you're talking about a disclosure of facts there in contrast to a revelation of truth. Right. So even how important it is that they've disclosed some of the facts that they have to the, you know, to the approximate degree that they have, again, remember, the only reason to have those accurate facts disclosed is so that through those you can find the truth. Right. The number is not truth. The number is just a fact. You know, the revelation of truth cannot be seen. It has to be recognized. You know? So you're always looking to see if you can strike step with what's beyond the immediacy of the words and their facts. No matter how delightful it might be to finally have some of these facts pinned down, and how significant that might be. Okay. Did you have something, Gene?
I was thinking... I don't have the capacity to appreciate a finer detail, but that's not really pertinent. Mm-hmm. It's we can appreciate these numbers like they give them. We don't need that for precision.
Right. I mean, and there's always that basic issue that first and foremost, what's in your lap is a metaphysics. Not a physics. You know, it's a philosophic text. It's a true metaphysics. It's the only way you can get true metaphysics is through revelation. You know, it's not first and foremost a scientific text, nor is it a religious text. Right? It's our job to do the science and the religion part, you know, in general. Right. It's their job to give us the framework for true science and true religion, to give us the metaphysics, not to mention the framework for a true philosophy. You start with the truth, you start with the philosophy, and then you go down to the material facts of science and the spirit facts of religion. I definitely want to, I'll probably bring it up, many times as we go forward, because we're going through a lot of seemingly just disclosure of facts. Try to remind yourself that that's not the primary purpose. To give you what happened X number of years ago, just factually. Try to appreciate what the even bigger picture is. What the wholeness is, what the truth is. Okay. All right. So let's do this first paragraph here and kind of get the ball rolling here finally.
1. The Andronova Nebula. Urantia is of origin in your sun, and your sun is one of the multifarious offspring of the Andronova Nebula, which was one time organized as a component part of the physical power and material matter of the local universe of Nebadon. And this great nebula itself took origin in the universal force charge of space in the super universe of Orvantan long, long ago.
Okay, but not in a galaxy far, far away.
Right, I was going to say.
All right. Okay, so, they're going to start with, we'll get into this. It very much begins as a nebula, where it's just gas, and then gas and dust. Eventually evolves into a galaxy of stars. Okay, this little, eventually a little spiral galaxy, vastly smaller than the Milky Way galaxy. Relatively speaking, tiny, right? A spiral galaxy compared to the Milky Way. This little spiral galaxy that's going to be initiated, and our sun comes from that material. Hence, our Earth comes from that material. Okay, the Andronova Nebula. And notice in there, which was one time organized as a component part of the physical power and material matter of the local universe of Nebadon. Remind ourselves of that. We stressed that many times, back in previous papers when this came up. The Andronova Nebula is just a part, of the local universe of Nebadon. And a relatively small part. I remember as we did some back-of-the-envelope calculations as we ran into things like, we could do a little kind of rough estimate of, what fraction, and we got things like 1/20th or 1/9th. Right? So at the best, we had 1/9th of Nebadon. Okay, so
still a lot of potential planets.
Lots and lots of planets, right? But, far short of enough material to make a whole local universe out of this little spiral galaxy. Okay, so they're reminding you of that right there, just a part. So don't get confused if later on it says something that seems to make it sound like it's the whole of it. It's not, so don't misinterpret those passages.
What's the term multifarious mean?
Oh, yes. That you've got many different modes there, of functioning. Okay, it's a menagerie, of offspring.
Dark islands.
This is all kinds of different things come out of that one very homogeneous starting point.
Double star.
Okay. Okay, so let's see, what else we have in there? Like I said, we're literally going to start with the force charge of space, with the primordial force. And, where this is being initiated is outside of the Milky Way galaxy proper. Outside of that whole big system that, was already, well down the road by the time this story starts, right? They're starting up this little spiral galaxy, and it eventually is going to get incorporated into the Milky Way galaxy, gravitationally drawn in, and we'll see them, referring to that between the lines as we go forward. Okay, so that's the basic idea. You're in the super universe level. I mean, it's outside of the Milky Way galaxy, but, not very far away. It's definitely not radially outward away, right? Because then you're going to get into the first outer space level. Right? It's just off to the side. Around the super universe level, So just off to the side from the Milky Way proper. Okay. This next little thing here.
At the time of the beginning of this recital, the primary master force organizers of Paradise had long been in full control of the space energies, which were later organized as the Andronova Nebula.
Okay, so they throw in that little tidbit. Because remember, there's two steps to this, because you have two different types of force organizers. You have the primary eventuated master force organizers and the associate transcendental master force organizers. So in other words, the primary and the associates. Okay, and they're going to start the story post what the primaries do. They're going to pick up the story when the associates step in. So in other words, what has happened? If you recall back from them explaining that, you have the uniform force charge of space, okay, in the super universe level. And the primaries have already started up a whirl in that force charge. But there's no automatons there yet, because it's the associates, that take it that next step from the whirl in the force charge, heading towards the automatons. Okay, so as the story starts, the whirl is already there in the force charge. The primaries have done their thing, and you'll get the impression here as we start reading that, it was sometime in the past. You can just see how had long been in full control. Of course, they're doing really big picture stuff. So they've initiated some whirl, as sort of a potential, from our perspective here. The potential's in place, but nothing's been actualized from this perspective of our story. And they've initiated that potential, in some very big context of, knowing how this fits into the big picture. Because they're master force organizers, like master architects. These are very big picture, individuals. And especially the primaries, remember, they're not transcendental. They're, as the name says for the associates, they're eventuated. Right? So they're definitively bounded away from the finite, definitively up in the absonite as an absonite being. They don't play on the boundary between the absonite and the finite like the transcendental, the associate transcendental ones do. Right. So, they have this very, mysterious relationship to the finite, as we understand it, even. It's a lot of mystery of how they can localize one of these worlds, even, right? I mean, you have all of that. There's kind of a mystery of mystery things going on there. But however that happens, there's a whirl. There's a little whirl, and then the story begins. Okay, so let's read that next one.
987 billion years ago, associate force organizer and then acting inspector number 811,307 of the Orvontan series, traveling out from Eversa, reported to the Ancients of Days that space conditions were favorable for the initiation of materialization phenomena in a certain sector of the then easterly segment of Orvontan.
Okay, so you see initiation of materialization. Right? To really, you know, get it to the point where we're going to talk about particles, you know, like the first particles, the automatons.
The most interesting thing here, I think, is a trillion years ago. I mean, 987 billion years ago. It's like...
Yeah, so...
And the next one goes to, I'm going to skip, goes to 900. So they go through 87 billion years as if it was nothing.
Right. Yeah, so...
Fathom.
Right, so definitely.
Plan ahead of time.
Yeah, so definitely one of the things that you see, right up front, is the enormity of that number. 987 billion years ago. Like you were joking a little bit ago, that is indeed a lot bigger number than 13.8 billion. You know, which is the current notion of how long ago the magical Big Bang occurred. You know, it isn't surprising that you can't precisely pin down when the magical event occurred. You know, so I'll give them that. Right, the universe didn't begin in a Big Bang, you know, a magical event. So it's not surprising that number has no relationship to reality. Magic has no relationship to reality. Universe is, you know, is 100% logical, zero magic. All right, so now when they said had long been in full control in that previous paragraph about the primaries, remember how we also ran across, you know, the bigger context of, you know, an estimate of how long the super universe level has been in play. Before 987 billion years ago. Remember, that estimate was 300 trillion years ago. The super universe level started. So there is a huge story prior to even 987 billion years ago, right, that led up to, so obviously you can have a quite significant Milky Way galaxy phenomenon assembled out of, you know, these smaller objects, you know, that's gone on trillions and trillions of years, okay, prior to this, spinning up this one and bringing it into a well-established system. It's had hundreds of trillions of years of evolution, eventuated into it already, if you will, you know, completed in it. Okay, so, but you see these associates take on this role in the story that's a lot like, you know, we're talking about a lot of other beings. You know, they're traveling out from Yversa, right? Now, it's not like they have some very transcendent relationship to finite, you know, distances and stuff, and are sort of omnipresent or something, right? I mean, like I said, that's why they call them transcendental, because they function right on the boundary line there. So they are definitively focusing their attention. You know, they are headquartered on the super universe headquarters worlds, or they're, in our case, headquartered on Yversa, and are going out exploring, and they discover there's this whirl in the force charge, or this. One associate or force organizer discovers that there's a whirl that's ripe for stage two. Okay, comes back to Yversa and reports it to the Ancients of Days. All right, and then that last little bit about in a certain sector of the then easterly segment of Orvintan. Remember what they tell us way back in the earlier part of the book, that you know, you've got the whole donut of space that is the super universe level around the central universe, and you chop that vertically into seven segments, seven chunks, right? And the seven super universes, you know, one of those segments of that donut, and our segment, is now really swinging up around the bend, you know, of the south, and then, you know, starting to move, you know, towards that long northerly, line up that long ellipse,
Which would be the east of it, right?
Yeah, on the east side, right? Yeah. That, and see here, right? See, you know, so way back then, okay, it would have been much more still down at the bottom and not so much, you know, turning up around the bend like it is now. 987 billion years ago, it's a long time ago. See, so it's, you can tell by the way they're saying that, it's much more kind of just think of it as, you know, as sort of a segment that's oriented east-west, right? And you got the Milky Way galaxy in the middle, and it's in to the side to the east is where they're spin, you know, is where this is being spun up.
I was trying to hint at the fact that it takes about a trillion years to go all the way around because we were almost back to the easterly part again.
No, we don't know how long it takes to go all the way around.
I'm just saying, I was just thinking it might be hinting that because if it was at easterly then and we're tracking our way up.
No, it's not. No, no, it's not in the easterly part of the circuit. It's in the easterly part of the segment, right? You've got this segment, you know, along the southern chunk there, you know, that's oriented east-west, right? The Milky Way is on the south end,
right.
Yeah. And there's
the Milky Way is with the other seven super universes you're talking about, right? In other words, that Milky Way as a segment of. The universe of universes, so to speak.
No. Remember, the Milky Way is the one galaxy, big galaxy, in the seventh super universe.
Right.
So the seventh super universe, hence the Milky Way galaxy, is down at the south end. Right. And the whole super universe segment occupies a chunk of that south end of the big ellipse around the central universe.
And the other super universes occupy the rest.
All the way around. Right. Yeah, you know. Here's so one, and here's
the easterly part of that chunk.
Right, so that chunk on the south end, right, has a west side and an east side.
Okay.
Right, they're spinning up Andromeda in that part that's still in the seventh super universe, but to the east of the Milky Way proper, right, out there in that space. In the same way, we see little dwarf galaxies around the Milky Way right now that are part of the seventh super universe. Right, but they haven't been incorporated into the Milky Way proper yet. Like the large and small Magellanic clouds are two little spiral galaxies that got spun up like this, you know, and are being brought into the Milky Way.
So the Milky Way is not rotating itself?
Right, the Milky Way galaxy is rotating, yeah. Right, but it's in a segment, it's just...
So the segment's not rotating?
No, of course not. I mean, the segment is just a segment of the donut.
But... the major motion of the segment is rotating internally, the Milky Way. I mean, that's most of it.
Right, but again, you got a chunk of space.
Yeah.
Right.
But aren't things around it, like if you spin up the Andromeda galaxy next to the Milky Way, that's going to be caught in the motion of the Milky Way.
Right, I mean, there's the whole dynamics of it coming in. That's a very complicated problem. It's going to, you know, come in and, right, I mean, it has to be guided in and all that. Yeah, I mean, it's a very complicated dynamics.
So what he's asking is, if the seventh segment is moving as part of their...
But this little thing is spun up outside of the whirl of the Milky Way.
Yeah.
It's not in the whirl of the Milky Way. It's outside of the whirl of the Milky Way.
So...
There's big chunks of the seventh super universe that are not part of the whirl of the Milky Way.
Okay.
To the east and west.
Is everything eventually going to be part of the whirl? I mean, does it all eventually...
No, eventually the whirl all goes away, remember. The world gets turned into automatons.
Say goodbye to your worldview.
Of the Milky Way.
Yeah, of everything. The puissant energy.
Yeah.
You know, we're about to read about that.
I guess I don't mean whirl, I mean motion of the Milky Way. Is it always going to have an internal...
Sure, yeah. I mean, well, and who knows what happens when the grand universe is settled in light and life, you know, and stuff. But yeah, I mean, for the time being, yes. I mean, the stars go around and around the center of the Milky Way galaxy, yeah.
And so all the stuff, like, when, say, the Andromeda galaxy gets, you know, new ones get organized, it all gets kind of incorporated into the whole internal...
They bring them in, you know, to the swing around the center, yes.
Yeah.
Right, they have to strike step with a system that's swinging around the center of the Milky Way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so then it's seems a little, you know, that's not going to, you know, it's all going to move, it's not going to... What was in the south, on the east side of the thing when it's south, it's not going to just move the block. It's going to move and be moving.
Right. Well, but again, remember, we're ignoring all of those kind of motions you're talking about. And nothing we're talking about right now has anything to do with the Milky Way going around or anything like that. And we're ignoring all that. We're just, you know, I mean, just think about, forget about the rotation of the Milky Way, or even the rotation of the Andromeda Nebula around its center, anything like that. Just think of them as static objects. You've got one object in the middle of the seventh segment and an object that's off to the east side in that segment, and you're just going to bring the small one into the center, right? But while it's coming in like that, the whole segment is beginning, is moving up around the easterly bend and starting to head northward in a big elliptical path around the central universe. I see. And everything within inside, moves as a unit. And there's all kinds of internal motion, but the whole, unit is moving around the big ellipse around the center.
That long ago, it could have been further. It may not be that far, as it says it is right now. In other words, right now, we're moving past the south bend. But a trillion years ago, here, we may have been...
That's what I said. I mean, you can tell by the way they're saying it. You're definitely just down on the south end, where the segment is basically just occupying the south end, and you've got a part to the west and a part to the east. Mm-hmm. And as not a part to the northeast. You can tell by the way they're saying that it must be pretty much just down on the south end there. But note there, it's 987. They do give you three significant digits. Right? They do it twice here in this early part of the story for these beginning points. They do give you a little bit more precise beginning point for some reason. That's kind of interesting to speculate about. But then the rest of the time, just a couple of significant digits at best. And speaking about precision, we need to know that he's inspector number 811,307, apparently, not 306. There you go.
What did you call him? Number 811307? It's more about the number than the sequence he appeared in, right?
No. Oh. As you can kind of tell, as we read further in the story, it certainly seems that there's some kind of a series here where the number has some relevance. That they're doing certain jobs at certain times in the whole process of the whole seventh super universe coming together. Again, we'll kind of talk about that in a little bit here, but just note that they give you this, it's like giving you the exact number for, our creator sun, right? They do that often. They give you this very precise number. And we've always said when we run across those, like, well, I don't know what exactly to do with all of that precision of that number, but at least I know it reminds me that the universe is very precisely ordered. Right? There's no slop. I mean, they may be only giving us one or two significant digits, but they know it to, as precise as you want it. Right? I mean, there is... Everything in the universe is very, very precisely done. Right? There is no good enough for government work sort of stuff going on in the universe of universes. Right? So you at least always have that truth flowing through such a disclosure of a precise factual number like that. You should remind.
Yeah, it may not even be that number anymore. So it's the then acting.
Right, I mean, there's some other one, it was acting, very immediately after that. But, they purposely assigned 811307 to that job, not 306 or 308 for some reason that's beyond our understanding. All right, they didn't pick his number out of a hat. Right, that inspector and only that inspector. Could be that inspector then at that for that job. There's some precise reason for it. Just know that truth. Never believe that you live in a universe where something is not being noticed. Some ball is being dropped. Right. You should despair, commit suicide. No. Right? Everything is very precisely known. Right? This planet is administered as if it's the only planet in the entire master universe. There is no precision, you know, no number too great for the administrators of the universe of universes to not handle. They know what every single-celled organism is doing at every nanosecond, at every location in the entire, you know, master universe, entire grand universe. I mean, everything is precisely known. Just know you live in such an ordered universe, right? It's a universe of order. Right? They know every thought, you know, they know everything you do, right? Everything is known. Everything is cared for, tended to. You know, if they want to know every thought of, you know, of some opossum somewhere, they can know every thought of that opossum. I mean, right, nothing is beyond their grasp. Okay, so in that incredible ordered context, you've got this amazing thing starting 987 billion years ago. All right, let's go to the next one here.
900 billion years ago, the Uversal archives testify there was recorded a permit issued by the Uversal Council of Equilibrium.
Yeah, the Uversal Council, yeah.
To the Super Universe government, authorizing the dispatch of a force organizer and staff to the region previously designated by inspector number 811,307. The Orvontan authorities commissioned the original discoverer of this potential universe to execute the mandate of the Ancients of Days, calling for the organization of a new material creation.
Okay, so they're not going to be functioning as an inspector anymore in the story. He's going to take the lead on this materialization project. Okay, so just one little thing to note there. So just the time it took to go from discovery to issuing the permit, okay? Just from the discovery, I want to say it again, from the discovery to issuing a permit was more than five times as long as as scientists currently believe the age of the universe is. That's how trivial 13.8 billion is. Okay, like you've heard me say before, right? There is no difference between saying that the universe is 13.8 billion years old and saying that the universe was created on October 22nd in 4004 BC. You know, Archbishop Usher's calculation back at the beginning of the Enlightenment, you know, based upon his best analysis of the chronology in the Old Testament. Yep, 6 p.m. 6 p.m., October 22nd, 4004 B.C., right? Yeah, remember that, you know, the importance of sunrise and sunset, you know, in Jewish thinking. Yep.
Well, there's something else here because conditions were favorable 987 billion years ago. The permit wasn't issued until 87 billion years after that.
You'll get to this in the just.
Which means the time of the permit, it wasn't determined by the conditions in the Andromeda or in the world. It was had to be determined by something greater than that. Where it was going to go, what was going to be.
Yeah, and I won't respond to that until we need to read just a little bit more. There's something that kind of addresses that here in just a second. But I want to stress that point. I mean, when the so-called sober modernist scientists poo-poo someone who would think, you know, in creationist terms, and adopt Archbishop Usher's date, you know, for the origin of the universe, you need to be transcendent of such foolishness. Right? There is no, in truth, There is no difference between 13.8 billion and 4004 BC. That's a difference of no consequence in the wholeness of what we're talking about. You know, a super universe level that was initiated probably 300 trillion years ago. Right? We have such a parochial consciousness in our supposedly dotting last I's, crossing last T's scientific world right now. Right? We know nothing yet. Right? And there's a truth, I'm stressing it, because, see, I'm trying to get to the truth. Right? Go beyond the fact of the difference between 13.8 billion years ago and 987 billion years ago. The truth of that, you know, how huge that is, how that should change your relationship to what mankind is doing right now, the certainty that mankind has about everything right now, right? The false religious certitude that scientists and religionists have, right? You know, and how that false certitude is the same false certitude, right? It's the ignorance of immaturity. It's tadpoles thinking they're frogs. Right? And so it's very important to, to just let it sink in. I mean, just that simple little thing should change your entire worldview. You know, you don't have to read any more of it. Just those two blocks and the difference between those two numbers, right, is so much greater than 13.8 billion. Okay.
And even more than that, it kind of helps me not be in a hurry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Won't stop. It was
well,
it,
and we're. I mean, if you, when you really think this through, you know, and you look at the number of Michael 611, we're one of the newer universes,
right?
And so that's like, and it's yes, time is real, but the time that as we look at it,
actually, no, time isn't real.
Well, you know what?
Time is an appearance. I see.
The sequence of events maybe is real, let's put it that way or whatever. But experiencing all that stuff, I mean. You know, for us and my little view, time is somewhat real.
Yeah.
You know, I have to live with that.
Right, right. We have to conform to time. Yes.
But the whole concept here of what you were just saying about trying to take a much longer look at things, this just makes you think like, oh my gosh,
Right. Remember how they tell you should eternalize your consciousness. Right. This is a start. Right.
Well, it's even back to where they talk about the adjudication of the rebellion. They say something like, it's only a couple of days worth or something like that. Whereas it seems like a long time for us.
Right, right.
I mean, why didn't they do anything about it now?
Right. But, remember, that's that's what I'm referring back to. That's where that 300 trillion calculation comes from. Okay. And I was just going to remind you of that context, they were reminding you of the perspective on things that the ancients of days have. Right, where we judge things by 100 years. Well, they judge things by 300 trillion, and counting. Okay, and so 87 billion years.
It's quick.
Right.
Well, but they still have to live every day, right, or every moment.
Sure. Right, but they. But again, see, the point is not that they don't pass through every moment like we do. They aren't transcendent of time. It's just they don't merely live in time. They really live. They start with eternity, and then they go to time. Okay? And yes, it's easier for someone who's been around that long to start with eternity and then go to time. But we can do that too, right? You don't have to be an ancient of days to start with eternity and then go to time. Don't start with time and then imagine eternity, because that isn't a real eternity, and you aren't really living in time either.
We can start with eternity?
Yes, we can, because we've been given a gift to connect us to eternity. Right? Now, technically, eternity for you will be supremacy. But that's effective eternity, right? You know, start with something that's transcendent of all temporality. And then, in that context, think about your task in the next 5 minutes. Put it in context, right? Don't try to make the next 5 minutes eternity. You know, it's so important. I mean, this is like existential stuff that's happening in the next 5 minutes here, right? That's way too much pressure to put on yourself. Right? No, it's just 5 minutes, and it's nothing in the context of eternity. Start with the peace that passes all understanding that eternity gives you. Time can't give you the peace that passes all understanding. Right? Jesus had that peace because he had eternity, not because he had time. Right? Time can't give you that. You start with, if you have that peace, you will do well with those 5 minutes. If you start with, I've got to make these 5 minutes everything, you'll blow it.
We have a tendency to do that as
right.
a species.
Right, right, you will, you know. And we all know you blow it.
It's only 5 minutes
it's
left.
Too much pressure. You can't handle it. It's like, you know, I've got to existentialize the next 5 minutes. Right, just try, so again, see that these are some of the basic truths that are just there. That's the low-hanging fruit of truth here as we start reading. But it's some of the most important stuff, right? And if you don't start with eternity, you don't have religion. You have a delusion. Religion is your binding to eternity. You know? And so all those people that don't have eternity, they may say they have religion, but they do not in truth, right? They only have religion superconsciously by grace. They don't have it consciously. The thing that they're thinking of and calling religion is bound to time. It's not bound to eternity. You know, like I was stressing, I think maybe the last session, right? The R-E means back. Back to eternity. Right? In religion. You know, it's not a-ligion. It's not bound to time, the object in time. It's bound back to eternity. That's why it's called religion and not all-ligion. And so, so if nothing else, right, as you read through all this stuff about the, historical geology, and not to mention these precursors things, it should get you out of that animal mode where you're so bound to time and encourage you to start with your humanity and then deal with the mundane issues of the animal and time.
Is that part of why Jesus was never in a hurry?
Right. Because eternity is not in a hurry. Time always is. Tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock, right? It's very incessant. Right? Never stops. You know, you're wishing that, can't you just stop that second hand for, you know, a little bit? I just need a breath. No, it won't stop. Right? But eternity, it doesn't have a second hand. You know, only in eternity is there stability. Right, so, all right, so
that's a pretty new concept, isn't it?
It's
not really.
It's sad to record.
I mean, you can tell the truth has been known long ago. The word religion wasn't coined yesterday. Why did they call it religion? Right? Why is it talking? You know. About being bound back. All right. So there's that, just that basic issue of how small 13.8 is. Right? I mean, just a simple logical reflection on the difference between 13.8 supposedly for the whole universe and 4.5 billion for the Earth. Does that feel true, right? That the Earth is almost as old as the entire universe? Does that even remotely feel valid to you? Right? It's like, well, the data says so, so it must be. It's like, no, that's reductio ad absurdum. You got to know that. Something is not correct. See, and actually, both numbers are incorrect. But we'll get to that later. Okay, into the details here. Just wanted to remind you of a little something here. They brought up this Uversa Council of Equilibrium. we saw them before. Back in paper 29, when they were talking about the master physical controllers, and you don't have to turn there. Again, I'll just remind you. They introduced that council that they're putting into practice here. They said that there's this council of equilibrium that are the high commissioners of power dispatched by the seven master spirits from the personnel of the associate master force organizers. So that sounds like, you know, it's not a group of associate master force organizers, but personnel. It's probably some unrevealed beings. Because they are described as power, you know, high commissioners of power. So it's probably, assistance to the associate master force organizers that are even more immediately involved in the finite side of the boundary between the absentite and the finite. Okay? Yeah. So, but it is, you know, you can see that it's very much, this story starts out, it's all about the associate master force organizers. The one who's going...
in communication with the masters. Otherwise, they wouldn't have to discover it. They'd just ask.
Yeah, right. You can see that once you're kind of down in the trenches, even at the very high levels of the trenches like these beings are, you know, it's an experiential domain. You're curious, you're searching, you're discovering, right? You're acquiring experiential nature, right? And, so...
that's kind of the beauty of it.
Yeah, and it's just... obviously, if the associate transcendental master force organizers are in that discovery mode, you're not going to graduate from that anytime soon in your ascension career, right? So there's eternal discovery. You know? You'll be discovering forever. You won't be told in advance. So you've got this cool council of equilibrium. And they, you know, like it says there, they designate that our inspector to now take the new role as leading the group that's going to go out there. Okay, so let's read this next paragraph here.
The recording of this permit signifies that the force organizer and staff had already departed from Uversa on the long journey to that easterly space sector where they were subsequently to engage in those protracted activities which would terminate in the emergence of a new physical creation in Orvantine.
Okay, so this is how it relates to what you're talking about, Gene. So it's not like they didn't leave until the permit was recorded. right, they're already well on the way. Now, you're thinking, well, man, these beings must travel very fast. But it is, it is a long journey. It's way out there somewhere, hundreds of thousands of light years out there, somewhere in that easterly part of the seventh segment. You see how you've got the whole thing in play, but everything gets properly recorded about what's going on, and everyone after the fact can look up. Yes, no one did this without a permit, right? I mean, everything is all precisely administered, every I is dotted, every T is crossed. Everyone can go back and look. No associate transcendental master force organizers went rogue and just, did that Luciferian thing of, well, I don't care what anyone says. I'm going to go out and do this, because I think it's a thing to do. Right, so just that's the point of it all. I mean, the whole process is going, but in retrospect, basically everything is being precisely recorded. All right, so let's see. Anything else
I'm
there?
Struck by the fact that the same one who discovered it
Was
given waited around for 87 billion years. 87, oh, I'm sorry.
Only 87 billion years, come on.
How many billion years did it take him to discover it?
Right, right. The whole thing is just delightful, and it's, you know, it's incredible scope. You know, it sounds like a story that's happening over the course of a few months, you know, but it's tens of billions of years. You know, and you're left wondering, it's like, well, what occupies all that time? Well, think about all of the details that are involved here. And I mean, you got to have a lot of ducks in the row when when they go out to spin things up, and we'll see that as we start reading here a little bit. Okay, this has consequences, right? This changes everything, right? Every automaton in the whole super universe is now going to have to take this into account, right? Right. It's a so there's a lot of planning and a lot of you know, technical logistics, right, that have to be set up and whatnot. Okay, see, those protracted activities, okay, which would terminate. And also, just, you know, just coming, you know, they did say long journey. Yeah, so now for beings that would travel as fast as this, you know, long would is a relative thing, right? But they are, you know, kind of reminding you that they do have to actually journey. They don't just snap their fingers and boom, they're there, right? I mean, it is a journey to them. And it's a journey over a distance that for us would, you know, it's traveling in seraphim would take a really, really, really long time, right? Three times the speed of light, right? Okay, so that's all the, you know, they've got all the basics in play now. So now they're going to start really kind of getting into the details of the story. You know, and I'll just say it up front. So, you know, having kind of given you that sort of precursor stuff, you know, they're going to sort of like officially begin the story, like begin the story anew, and see how they give you three significant digits on the next, you know, age there again. Just to, as a little reminder visually there that they've kind of, okay, now let's like a really start the formal part of the story. You know, we've got all of the backstory done, right? Okay, so let's read next here.
875 billion years ago, the enormous Andronova Nebula, number 876,926, was duly initiated. Only the presence of the force organizer and the liaison staff was required to inaugurate the energy whirl, which eventually grew into this vast cyclone of space. Subsequent to the initiation of such nebular revolutions, the living force organizers simply withdraw at right angles to the plane of the revolutionary disk, and from that time forward, the inherent qualities of energy ensure the progressive and orderly evolution of such a new physical system.
Okay, so a number of things there. First of all, let's just notice that you've got they're numbering and sequentially numbering these little spiral nebulae, you know, eventually spiral galaxies, I should say, that they're spinning up. This is 876,926. Right, so just how many of these have already, you know, been spun up and gotten incorporated in the Milky Way? See, it's a large number.
A lot of permits.
A lot of stuff has gone on before this story. This is way down the road in the story of the seventh super universe. And you also notice, you know, it's in the same ballpark as our, you know, inspector number, 811,000. This is 876,000. So that's suggestive that, you know, there's some significance to, you know, that not being inspector number five. You know, there's some kind of a sequence of inspector numbers that's roughly similar to the sequence of galaxies that they're spinning up. You know, you get the impression that it's not always the case that the inspector is put on the job of being the one to actually do the materialization. Right? So, you know, they wouldn't be exactly the same number.
Right.
But see, there's some whole kind of rough parallel here between a sequence of inspectors and a sequence of nebulae being spun up. Okay.
Well,
yep.
Two things crossed my mind when they looked at that particular number. One is that if our Creator Son is number 600,000.
611,000.
700,000 total, approximately.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, maybe we're about 60-some-odd percent or 2/3 of the way through in Farbenthein being developed, and in which case, if that were the case, then we'd be looking at, you know, as you mentioned earlier, it's not just one nebula in any.
Sometimes it's one astronomic system that makes up a whole local universe, but definitely in ours, it's not.
A lot.
Yeah.
Are they also looking at nebulas that are outside of our super universe?
No, this is only within the seventh super universe, these numbers. This is a Uversa sequence. The other six super universes have their own set of sequences going on.
That number seems small.
Right, I was just going to bring that up. Okay, so 800 and some thousand, you know, does seem kind of smallish, right? Remember, you have stuff that's part of the Milky Way proper, too. Right? There's a giant world that was set up for the Milky Way proper, you know, and that world is being condensed into automatons and then eventually atoms and whatnot, right, within the Milky Way proper, but then you're also spinning up these other ones and adding to it. Right, see, so these are additions. That's why the number seems a little smaller than you might expect for the scale of the whole Milky Way. Right? Especially if you've got a lot of local universes that, you know, maybe this is only a 20th or something like that of the total mass in the local universe. You know, you're thinking, ought to be a little bigger number than that, shouldn't it? Right, but you got to see, this is a very complicated thing. It's like, well, why do they do that? Why don't they just do it all in one thing? Why do they spin up these little ones outside and bring them in and, you know, complicate the whole, who knows, right? There's some reason why it has this very complex evolutionary thing. You know, why does it take hundreds of millions of years? You have to go through all of the, you know, silly animals that we went through on this planet before we finally got Anna and Fanta, right? There's some reason that you need all of this complexity and all of this diversity in order to get your end result. We can't understand that, but we can definitely see it's a very, very complicated thing, what they're doing. You know, and they're going to spin up, these little ones they spin up are going to be all kinds of different sizes. You know, some of them are going to be a lot bigger than Andromeda, you know, and whatnot. So very, you know, very complicated phenomenon that they're doing. And only the master architects understand, you know, the why of it all, you know. Okay, so when they say only the presence of the force organizer and the liaison staff, we'll see here in just a little bit here, the liaison staff are additional associate transcendental master force organizers. You have a group of these associate force organizers that go out. And you can see by the way they describe them, it sounds like you've got the main one, our former inspector here in this case, who probably takes a central position in the whirl and the force charge. And then there's some sort of a liaison, together as one linking network of the others around him in the center. You know, and then they have this collective presence. And in that presence, they begin to condense the whirl and the force charge. Remember we talked about this way back when we were talking about the physics. That you have the motion that is that whirl and the force charge, and that's going to condense into units of motion, into automatons. Right? And eventually the whole whirl and the force charge, you know, is gone, is condensed into ultimatons, and the ultimatons collect into particles, and the particles collect into atoms, and you know, etc. Okay, but it's this condensation phenomenon, and see, so what they're doing is, as you can see, you know, they're there for, you know, just a while, relatively speaking here, and they set a direction to this, in, you know, process in play, and then they step back, and it just proceeds forward, this condensation, you know, and more of the world condenses into ultimatons, and eventually the whole world is gone, and it's nothing but ultimatons and, you know, subsequent particles.
Okay?
They don't have to stay there until the whole world is condensed into ultimatons. They initiate, it's very mysterious, and remember, none of the revelators understand this process at all. They initiate some sort of transcendental influence upon this world that gets the world condensing, and they don't have to stay there to keep it condensing. They initiate it, and it just goes on.
Just some kind of catalyst.
There's some sort of, yeah, catalyst, and you know, and they obviously must have to stay for a while. You can tell they don't just go there and go boom and then walk off. You know, it's not an instantaneous thing.
What's the right angles to the planet?
Okay, so that bit. Okay, so they've got this whole system set up. It has this beautiful planar symmetry. They've got to exit at right angles to that, or they'll disrupt the symmetry. Right? If they moved off like this, you know, they'd produce an asymmetry. You know, they have to move at right angles so that, you know, they don't disrupt the symmetry of the whirl.
Yeah. Yeah. Has to do with their coupling.
They would approach it at right angles too, right? I mean, they don't mention that, but you know, they go in, you know, and you know, they must, like I said, they must be some sort of like a grid of their liaised, you know, presence. Okay. They bring that in and then pull it out. I mean, I don't know if they come from both sides. They all come from one direction. I don't know.
Right, I was envisioning the pulling out was actually getting the thing, but it's not.
No, it's not. Remember, the actual whirl was done before they got there.
Yeah.
You know, that was done by the primaries.
Yeah, but there's nothing you can see there because it's not slowed down enough. The particles.
Right, I mean, you know, you're not going to see anything until you get, you know, some sort of object that's radiating, you know, giving off photons. You know, the ultimatons, you can't see the ultimatons there either.
It's still energy that hasn't been turned into matter yet, correct?
Well, that's what I'm saying too, right? I mean, you know, you haven't gotten it to universe power yet. You know, initially you just have puissant energy, that whirl in the force charge, and you've got ultimatons, you know, et cetera. And, you know, it's only down the road that you finally get something that is, you know, electronic level matter that's, you know, going to do things like emit photons or whatever. Okay, so, you know, you're in this very early stage. You know, the whole point of the primaries is to start the whirl. The associates just get going from whirl to ultimatons. And everything after the ultimatons, the power beings come in, remember. When you're in the super universe level, the power beings come in and if anything's going to be done, it's done by them subsequent. Out in the outer space levels, there's no power beings, you know, right now. You know, so remember, this group, you know, however many it is, this group of associate transcendental master force organizers stays with each of those galaxies. Like I said, it's just think about how cool it is to look at a picture of a whole bunch of galaxies out there in the outer space level. Every one of those is a collection of associate transcendental master force organizers, you know, who'll be present there until the grand universe is settled in light and life, apparently.
Even though there are material planets out there, you know.
There's no creatures out there, you know, or anything, you know, per se. Yeah, you know. Right, but
those matter, it has condensed to where you can.
They stay there and do some. They're doing some sort of a long term shepherding of those evolving galaxies out there. You know, in the super universe level, they shepherd it for just a short period of time, and then they back off. You know, and the power beings, you know, the centers and the master physical controllers come in. You know, and do anything else beyond, you know, after that. And we have no idea what all an associate force organizer can do. Beyond this initial stuff, they never explain that. You know, how much are they doing out there in the outer space levels? We don't know. Okay, but we do know that they're there. Every one of those galaxies. And so when galaxies merge out there, right, that's groups of force organizers are merging into one group. And right, there's all this synchronization of their activities. And so millions and millions and millions of groups of associate force organizers out there and those incredible vistas of galaxies out there. Anyway, back to the story here. So like I said, they have to leave it right angle so they don't disturb the symmetry of the disk. Yeah, and, so in very short order, we're going to have a bulging disk, right, of gas, right, bulging towards the center. But it started out as just a field of ultimatons, and the ultimatons had to collect together into groups of 100 and et cetera. So it's going to take all this long process before you have atoms there, right, at all, because it's just starting out with nothing but ultimatons. Okay, let's see. Did I get everything else there? Oh, that's right. I was going to comment. Notice the precision of language. They say the force organizer and the liaison staff are required to inaugurate the energy whirl. It's like, well, wait a minute. Didn't we do that way back before the story started? Didn't the primaries? No, the primaries initiated the whirl. The secondaries are inaugurating it. They're sort of like I said. Notice that. The story got started again here with three significant digits in the number. I mean, this sort of formal beginning of the process, is an inauguration of the process. Yeah. But the literal, just mere initiation was back there sometime before 987 billion years ago. See, so they're very, they're very... careful to pick words that are appropriate. You can look up in the dictionary about that essence of that difference between saying something is initiated and something is inaugurated. Right?
What was there when the inspector got there is something only the inspector could tell was there.
Yeah. And just, humans use that word inauguration like, you've got something totally finished, completed a building or something, and then you inaugurate it, or a ship, So it's not the very, very beginning that it's where it's inaugurated. It's a formal beginning, So that's why they said it that way.
January 20th.
Let's see. So, like an inauguration, right? Like on January 20th. And so just like I was going to emphasize, the inherent qualities of energy. Right? So. There's, they're building into this some sort of a directionality, right? That the energy doesn't inherently have. They're giving it this inherent directionality, so they can step back and it just evolves, forward, without them having to be actively present. They don't have to micromanage it forward. They instill that direction into it. It's like what the life carriers, we'll be reading in a while, them doing. They don't micromanage it all the way from single-celled plants to humans. They basically put that direction into that single-celled plant, and the direction goes forward and out comes the will creatures that they designed hundreds of millions of years later. Through an incredibly complex process.
And something steps on it.
Okay. And if something steps on it, they've already planned for that. And
Well, since all the matter in the seven super universes is the same,
essentially.
Are you sure the secondary force organizers insert pattern into this matter, or is it?
No, no, I didn't say pattern. I said direction.
Direction.
They're giving it some kind of a direction, you can see here. They're fathering it, right?
Okay.
You know, that initiating and directionizing, you know, they're fathering it. They're putting an influence into it, like the Universal Father put an influence into you, your personality, right? This directionizing influence, you know, into your mindal self. They're doing a similar thing here. You're giving it this direction, and now it embodies that direction. You know, they don't have to stay there and keep, you know, nudging it, directionizing it, right? Just like the Father doesn't have to be there, you know, constantly tweaking you along. Right? It gives you the personality, and then it's inherent. And so that's what they're getting at here. It's a father-like thing they're doing, not a mother-like thing that they're doing. At least here, right? You can wonder about what's going on in the outer space levels where they stay there with it as a presence, see? But here, no. All right, let's get that last paragraph there.
At about this time, the narrative shifts to the functioning of the personalities of the super universe. In reality, the story has its proper beginning at this point, at just about the time the Paradise Force organizers are preparing to withdraw, having made the space energy conditions ready for the action of the power directors and physical controllers of the super universe of Orvantan.
See, I already kind of told you that. See how there's two beginnings. There's the beginning that has three significant digits, and here's the proper beginning, where they give you three significant digits in the date. So that's the basic story. So now, like I said, we're going to start talking about this nebula. And let me just speak to that a little bit more. Someone who knows the history of astronomy in the early part of the 20th century knows that we used to, in general, call, say, for instance, the Andromeda, not to be confused with Andromeda here, the Andromeda galaxy, we used to call that the Andromeda Nebula. Okay? And so a lot of people falsely assume that this is just baggage from the beginning of the 20th century, that they're using the nebula term here. No. It's not initiated as a system of stars. Right? It's basically initiated as a system of gas. It's a nebula. Right? You'll see we'll go long ways in the story before we have any stars. Right? This is a nebula that we've initiated. It's a system of gas and dust. I mean, because eventually some of that gas is going to, you know, you're going to have dust there too. But you don't have stars, you know, or planets or anything. Okay, you just have gas and dust, like a nebula. Only it's not some just amorphous, you know, cloud, you know, like the Orion Nebula or something like that. All right, it's this very systematic cloud. You know, nebula means cloud, cloud of gas and dust. Okay, so we've got this. They're going to give you, there's several stages to this, evolution of this. So what starts out as a cloud of ultimatons, right? It's long before it's a cloud of gas. But we're going to skip all that stuff and, you know, just jump right to the point where we've gotten ultimatons together into collections of 100. So we have particles, and then those particles have collected together into systems that are called atoms. And, okay, we'll have some basic molecules and, right, so you're going to have a cloud of gas. Okay, so let's go to the rest, more of the story here.
2, the primary nebular stage. All evolutionary material creations are born of circular and gaseous nebulae, and all such primary nebulae are circular throughout the early part of their gaseous existence. As they grow older, they usually become spiral and when their function of sun formation has run its course, they often terminate as clusters of stars or as enormous suns surrounded by a varying number of planets, satellites, and smaller groups of matter in many ways resembling your own diminutive solar system.
Right, so in a simple picture, you got a bunch of gas that you can visualize condensing into a single object. But that would be a really huge object if it just did that. A lot of the mass is going to be thrown off, you know, and you're going to have individual stars made out of that, just like our sun, you know, some matter got disgorged to make the planets. But when all is said and done, you might end up with that residual amount of gas finally condensing into a big star, right, at the center. Okay. Or at least a system of stars, a globular cluster. Yeah. Okay. They didn't mention it was a globular there. They do that a little later on. But that's one of the ways you can get a globular cluster. Is like that. Okay, so, and then they notice how it's not a spherical cloud. They use the labeling circular. Because it's starting out as a disk, right? That's going to bulge, you know. And so you'll have this bulged in the center disk, okay? "Quote unquote," a circular nebula, a circle is symmetric. You know, all angles around the circle, and any angle is the same, right? It's symmetric. There's no spirals in it or anything like that. Patchwork. It's this nice smooth. A circular nebula. The only variation is it's starts to get thicker, more ball-like, bulged in the center as it evolves. Just gravity pulling things towards the center. Okay, but you basically have all initially all those ultimatons are caught in that very disc flat whirl in the force charge. Okay, that's the starting point. All right. Let's see, anything else there? You can see how they stress it's a gaseous nebula. So as we start going forward, and especially when you get to the spiral, don't think galaxy, right? It's just a nebula still. It's nothing but gas and dust, for a long ways in this story yet. Okay.
800 billion years ago, the Andronova creation was well established as one of the magnificent primary nebulae of Orvontan. As the astronomers of nearby universes looked out upon this phenomenon of space, they saw very little to attract their attention. Gravity estimates made in adjacent creations indicated that space materializations were taking place in the Andronova regions, but that was all.
Okay, so what have they added to the story here? So we've gone 75 billion years, roughly, into the story. In gravitational terms, that's a long time. A lot can happen in 75 billion years in a gravitating system of things. Notice how this little nebula is not so far outside of the Milky Way anymore, right? They're starting to talk about adjacent creations. Okay, when it's way out there, there's nothing adjacent, it's all by itself. Okay, it's been, the Milky Way galaxy has been pulling it in for 75 billion years now. Okay, scientists rationalize that they can do all the gravitational stuff that, we see in 13.8 billion years. Okay, so 75 billion years, okay, that's a long time for, right? It's moved in and it's getting close to the Milky Way, and everyone in the Milky Way galaxy, all the power beings in the Milky Way galaxy, it's like, oh boy, incoming, but they've been planning for this for billions of years, right? Everyone's got to take this into account, because this thing is incoming, right? It's got to be brought in a certain way. And every local universe, think about some of the local universes that have been around for trillions of years, are really, really settled. Yeah. Every ultimaton is in exactly the place they want it to be. Right. And in comes this rock into the nice placid pond. Yeah. Right? they've got it, you know, everyone's got, you know, especially the adjacent ones are like, oh boy, okay, here it comes, you know, they've got to keep their local universe, stabilized, you know, as this, you know, and you don't just have this one, remember, it's one part of many. They're building the local universe of Nebadon, you know, in amongst the other local universes that are already there, yeah. Right?
So why do they see nothing?
Okay, so like I said, I mean, if, you know, if you were to look out with a telescope, okay, you basically just have a cloud of gas that's not really radiating at all. Right? There's nothing to see. There's no stars giving off any light or anything yet. Right? And there's lots and lots of galaxies out there in the outer space levels that we can't see because they're not radiating anything yet. You know, they're big collections of gas that, we can't see yet. So as the astronomers of nearby universes, you know, like mortals on worlds, you know, deeply settled in light and life that know all this stuff and are studying and, they're looking for these incoming galaxies and, over the countless generations on those worlds, they've been tracking this, for billions of years, the astronomers have passing that story along, and each generation of astronomers is watching the next little segment. They're following all this, the building of the Milky Way galaxy. They know all this stuff, and so there's not much to look at initially. Right?
Isn't there? I think some of among the first types of radiations are the really short rays.
Right, you've got, right, yeah.
They can start to get a little...
They'll be observing, they're not just looking in optical, right? They're,
looking beyond.
They're not just looking in, even gamma rays, they're looking very, very short stuff, and, So they can start to pick up, a lot of that, those really, really short wavelength things that are coming from, even ultimatons forming, and then ultimatons collecting into systems of 100, and, all that stuff.
It seems like... Well, they indicate gravity estimates.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have any idea what they're talking about there?
You can start to estimate how much mass there is in that thing by how much it's tugging on you, right? You got these, and this would not just be celestial beings, the celestial astronomers, but, mortal astronomers in a very advanced worlds would, be involved in this kind of stuff, too, of... Really, understanding. Remember how way back there, the celestial astronomers literally try to take a tally of, literally how much mass there is, everywhere by just sending out test particles, as it were, how much is it being pulled, and tallying it up.
Right.
Yeah. And they do that.
These astronomers on these advanced worlds, they can communicate with other worlds too.
Right, right, and there would be all kinds of interconnection
At this point, is the mass more or less set?
You'll see. They'll talk about that. Remember, if it's all ultimatons, it has zero mass.
Yeah.
Ultimatons don't have any mass.
Okay.
Right, you got to get to electronic level before you have any mass, there's this whole evolutionary process before it's, you finally have sort of a full materialization of it.
But the number of ultimatons is set.
Yeah, the number of ultimatons is set by how big the world was that the primaries put in play. That a certain size world will give a certain number of ultimatons.
It'll fit right in my computer.
It's going to be a large number. Yeah. Notice they don't say it directly, but if you reflect on what they say there, it's like, wait a minute, what is all this about adjacent creations and stuff? It's like, think. They're trying to get you to reflect, put the pieces together, see, and you can tell what's happened in the story here logically. It would be way coming in now, and so by the time we get very far into the story, you've got something that's fully down inside the Milky Way galaxy, and they don't tell you that, right? But that's happening, right? Before long in this story, it's all the way down, been incorporated into the Milky Way along with all the other stuff that they're bringing together to make Nebadon. Okay.
Now, was that just the gravity response part, or was that set in motion
We have no idea of how they do. You know, obviously, you know, if gravity can do it, they're going to let it. You know, yeah. But you know, they can't just let it, you know, go in willy nilly. So they've got to have ways of controlling this. All right.
700 billion years ago.
Again, the numbers are just so crazy. How many years 700 billion years ago?
Still
700 billion years ago. 700 billion years ago, the Andronovar system was assuming gigantic proportions, and additional physical controllers were dispatched to 9 surrounding material creations to afford support and supply cooperation to the power centers of this new material system, which was so rapidly evolving. At this distant date, all of the material bequeathed to the subsequent creations was held within the confines of this gigantic space wheel, which continued ever to whirl, and after reaching its maximum of diameter, to whirl faster and faster as it continued to condense and contract.
Okay, so again, you see him stressing. It's definitely getting really close. This is getting serious. I mean, they've got to dispatch extra master physical controllers to their surrounding local universes, or everything is going to go to hell in a handbasket, right, really fast. Okay.
Because there's so much energy.
It's just, you know, I mean, you've got, you know, think about, you know, and this is just the Andromeda Nebula. Remember, you've got all the other mass of the Nebulon too is all in play. Disrupting all of the surrounding region of the Milky Way galaxy, it can only disrupt so far. Like I said, especially if you're talking about a local universe that's way settled. Yeah. You know, if the local universe is still in a pretty early stage, okay, you know, like they can let things be pretty wild west in Norlacia Deck. Right, things are not very cleaned up, you know, in our constellation. It's pretty wild and woolly outside of the little bubble that we'll read about in a little, you know, in a while that they create for us here.
Tombstone.
Okay. But you know, definitely, if any of those nearby local universes are a long ways along, you know, they've dotted a lot of I's and crossed a lot of T's in that local universe, and you know, things are very precise. So they're going to have to bring in lots of master physical controllers to hold everything, you know, until this settles down after billions and billions and billions of years, right?
Get this thing coming in, a little support here.
All right, so big operation. Like I said, that's why, some of these numbers are so big, because it's just a massive project. All right, let's see. What else we have there? Okay, and then just that latter part of that paragraph. So you can see it's definitely evolved well along the point where, you know, we really have a gaseous phenomenon. This is a system of mass, okay? You know, and it's starting to do, you know, basic, you know, as we understand it, Newtonian gravitational things, where, you know, it's rotating and gravity is condensing it, so it's spinning faster and faster, just like the skater, you know, bringing in his or her arms, right? And so, you know, and it's going to start bulging more out in the center, and you know, so it's getting more bold, more of a bulging disk, and it's starting to spin.
Just like me as I get older.
And it's starting to spin faster and faster.
All I had to do was pull my arms in, and boom, I exploded like a nebula.
But you did notice, you know, that they say at this distant date, all of the material bequeathed to the subsequent creations was held, right? So, you know, it's nothing is flown away. You know, it's all still definitively contained within that initial whirl space, right?
By gravity, you think, or?
We haven't gotten far enough where anything can overcome gravity and fling anything out, right? So it's still a very tightly contained, you know, nebula. You know, everything's all very kind of still, you know, symmetric and uniform and clean. But things are going to start to get a little more complicated.
600 billion years ago, the height of the Andronova energy mobilization period was attained. The nebula had acquired its maximum of mass. At this time, it was a gigantic circular gas cloud in shape somewhat like a flattened spheroid. This was the early period of differential mass formation and varying revolutionary velocity. Gravity and other influences were about to begin their work of converting space gases into organized matter.
Okay, so you can see them kind of pointing out the, you know, the bulging thing that I was referring to there. And you also see, okay, finally here at 600 billion years ago, it's acquired its maximum of mass. And again, that's not because it's bringing in more stuff from the outside. More and more of the ultimatons are getting together into systems that are actually, you know, an electronic level phenomenon that has mass.
Committed ultimatons.
Right. Same set of ultimatons, initially zero mass, finally gets to universe power, as it's called, right? An electronic level phenomenon. Okay, now it has mass. Okay. It's acquired its maximum mass. So things have, you know, you don't have loose ultimatons anymore. Everything has gotten all collected together. Okay. And as they're pointing out, you know, more and more, I mean, initially that whirl in the force charge is rotating like a record bladder. You know, as the whirl condenses into ultimatons, you know, it starts to take on a more Keplerian, you know, or Newtonian, if you want, you know, sort of a thing where you've got, you know, just like the solar system doesn't rotate like a record bladder, right? It takes Pluto a lot longer to go around than it takes Mercury to go around. And you know, you still have, you haven't gotten all the way necessarily to that fully Keplerian, you know, variation of velocity with radial distance. But it's definitely beginning to move away definitively from being like a record bladder, a bunch of marker dots on a record bladder, right? You're starting to get a differential variation with radius, okay? You know, and we see when we look out there in the outer space levels, you know, we see these galaxies that where the velocity curve with radial distance from the center, you know, it doesn't drop off in Keplerian fashion with distance. Yeah, it also doesn't go up linearly like a record, like it was rotating, the whole thing was like a record platter. You know, it's basically constant with distance. You know, see, it's in between.
Right.
It's evolving from an initial record platter state to eventually it's fully Keplerian when the disk has been totally, the whirl has been totally condensed. Okay.
In fact, that's probably a pretty good measure for estimating how much stage
it's in. Right, right. So obviously, it would give you a relative time measure, right, of how far it is, you know, from a record platter state to, now, obviously, some of those galaxies, the barred spirals, you've got a central region that's still rotating like a record platter.
Right.
Right? Those bars aren't twisting into spirals. They're glued on a record platter, right, and rotating around.
But it's a nebula, kind of like I'm envisioning some scenes I've seen in Star Trek, where they actually fly their ship through a nebula, you know, and so it's gaseous still. In other words, you could,
right,
as opposed to there's really no planets there yet.
No, it's just a cloud. All of this is just a cloud of gas. Everything we're talking about here is just a cloud of gas and dust. Okay.
And we can see those on telescopes, can't we? Or not? Yes.
Well, one of the things that they're bringing in here is something that's not fully appreciated. How far along in the process of what we call galaxies evolving, it isn't a collection of stars. You know, it starts out fully gaseous, and a lot of it stays that way a lot longer than we imagine. Okay, yeah. So this is modifying a little bit what we think about the evolution of galaxies.
I mean, a lot of times when you see pictures that are taken by the Hubble or whatever, they say they're gaseous or nebulae, whatever.
Okay, I mean,
so how are they?
Now we see inside the Milky Way, there's, you know, just blobs of gas and dust,
yeah, right,
that are called nebulae, like the Orion Nebula, say.
Okay.
Okay, that has nothing to do with what we're talking about here. That's just a blob of gas and dust inside the Milky Way.
Oh, it's not something that's going to be turning into something else.
No, I mean, that's, you know, it might be condensing into stars eventually, but that's not one of these these things that we're talking about. Right? You know, that's a very small region, you know, relative to this. You know, that'll produce a handful of stars eventually inside the Milky Way.
Surplus ultimate times.
Right, like I said, remember,
not
there's
the creation of a
there's a whole process. You know, some of the mass in Nebadon didn't didn't come from these little galaxies that were brought in. Some of it evolved in place. Right? In between local universes right now in the Milky Way, there's a bunch of stuff already there that hasn't been incorporated into a local universe yet. There's enough that they can make a local universe totally out of the stuff that's already there, and they don't have to bring in anything new. You know, or sometimes they got to bring in a whole bunch of new stuff from the outside. Yeah, so like they say back there, it varies all over the map, all kinds of different ways that you get the amount of mass that you need for a local universe. Okay. But some of it is evolving in place, and we see that. You look through telescopes, there's all kinds of, you can't see very far in the plane of the Milky Way with a telescope because there's so much gas and dust. You know, when the grand universe is settled in light life, there's not going to be gas and dust anywhere anymore. Right? No stray matter. Okay. Everything will be incorporated into some final system.
I got you.
Okay. But right here, yes, we're just, even though we've obviously this Andromeda Nebula is down in the Milky Way now, we're ignoring the whole Milky Way and all of the stuff that's also part of Nebadon that's all around it. You know, we're just focusing on this one part of Nebadon. It's pretty much down there in the Milky Way now. And its evolution. And so it starts out, just like I said, this bulging circular nebula. And it's starting to get differential. And
200 billion years to get there.
Right. Just all these hundreds of billions of years. See, and, remember, when they look out in the outer space levels right now, they rationalize that all those galaxies have gotten to those states like that in 13.8 billion years.
How do they do that?
See? And then see, like I said, what they're telling you here has a lot of consequences for the time scales for those galaxies out there to evolve. See, it's a lot longer than anyone thinks. Okay?
Wow.
Takes a long, long time. Because, and part of it is, because scientists don't know about the whole sub-electronic domain of physical energy. It takes a lot of time for things to evolve to the point where it's the stuff that we know about. Right? If you just think that magically the stuff that we know about comes into existence in a magical Big Bang, okay. Once you have masses can gravitate, but it takes a long time to get masses. Right? Those systems of 100 ultimatons even, are not gravitationally pulled towards each other. There's no mass there.
But even that doesn't explain 13.8 billion years. That's, in other words.
Right. It's all envisioned as happening, quite magically fast.
Guessing, in your opinion?
No, you can rationalize this stuff. Remember, you can rationalize anything. They're not guessing. None of that's a guess. It's all exactly. They've got several decimal places. I think it's 13.799 plus or minus. It's all very
based
upon general relativity and all kinds of things. If you make all the assumptions you make, and you right. You rationalize it in those assumptions, and those are the numbers you get. Right? But we just forget that you're rationalizing things with a certain set of initial assumptions, and you're rationalizing what appears to you. You can't see the reality of it, and you certainly can't know how much goes into the reality of it. And that's kind of what I'm trying to get at here. A lot goes into the reality in an evolutionary way. Goes into the reality of the physical creation.
True,
right?
But even if you look towards the center, that's been around for trillions of years or whatever, in a fully material state. It's not developing in states that.
Are you talking about the central universe? No, what are you talking about?
Center of the Milky Way.
Oh, center of the Milky Way.
I mean, even if you look that way, as opposed to out in the outer space.
Right, levels. Right.
I mean, that's been there a long time. I mean, probably longer than the outer space levels, if you know what I'm saying. So I'm just curious as to, and that's been there in a fully material state.
But again, remember, see, all of the stars are vastly older. You know, they think the stars have a scale of billions of years. No, stars have a scale of trillions of years. You know, everything in the universe is older than anyone thinks. But, you know, if you have a certain set of assumptions, it all rationalizes together, you know, and everything fits in the current worldview. There's nothing, you know, it's all rational. Everything fits together.
Yeah, that's lots of precision, but no accuracy.
Okay.
What's so spooky about it?
Okay. Yeah. So it's just, you know, no one is ignoring something necessarily or just guessing or anything like that. I mean, no.
I mean, I bring this up to my friend Steve McIntosh,
okay,
who says, well, this is one of the reasons why the Urantia book's not right. Because, you know, we all know that it's only 13, 14.
Right. See, and
I say, Steve, no.
See, the reason that someone, you know, will think that current science is right and this is wrong is because they've forgotten what we learned 2,600 years ago in philosophy, right? That there's a difference between appearance and reality, right? And scientists can't observe reality, never will. It's impossible to observe reality. All you can observe is appearance, right? Reality has to be revealed to you. This is not a description of appearance. This is a description of reality. Scientists are describing an appearance and their rationalization of that appearance. This is describing the reality of it. And now our job is to understand the relationship between the appearance and our current rationalizations and the reality of it. It really is, you know, hundreds of billions of years old, say. Not a few billion. So what do you have to change in your current understanding, attempt to understand, to match that up?
Everything.
Right? That's the job of a scientist, to start with the revelation and then get that properly sorted out. Okay? You know, it's not the job of the scientist to believe that appearance is reality. But you can't tell that to a current scientist. Or people who believe that current scientists are authority figures. Right. Right?
Fiction writers can do that.
Okay. That's what you got to understand.
Some time they'll figure it out.
You know, and what they're telling you here can't be observed. So, of course, scientists haven't observed this. You can't observe this. Now you have to be told this. If we could observe it and figure it out, it would be a violation of the revelatory mandate for it to be in front of you. They can only tell you what you can't figure out yourself. So anything they tell you won't agree with what you've figured out. That's the whole point of a revelation. It's not an affirmation of your ignorance. It's a revelation of truth. It won't agree. And fundamentally, it won't agree because reality does not equal appearance.
Interesting.
Okay, let's see here, what do we, let's see, well, you know, we actually got to the end of that section, didn't we? Yeah, okay, let's just talk that through for another couple minutes and then we can wrap it up there. I was thinking we had a little bit more in that section.
This is the earliest we've ever.
Yeah, so.
Ever. Next week we're not here, right?
Let's think a little bit more about the big picture that we just covered there. You know, the kind of the formal story started at 875 billion years ago. Okay, and it took 175 billion years just to get to this point where you basically have something that we kind of currently understand. You know, a system of masses, a system of billiard balls, right, as it were. It's just gas. There's no stars. No gas and dust. There's going to be some dust too. This primary stage, this very initial stage, 275 billion years. That just kind of gets us to something that we might imagine right now as a starting point. Right, see, so the real evolutionary process for something simple like this, okay, takes, you know, let's say it takes 275 billion years. Okay, we have no concept of that mode of evolution. We think that the end point here is a beginning. And so what do we do? You know, we're going to have to introduce some sort of a magical process to make up for the absence of a real evolutionary process to get to our beginning. See, it should help to understand why we have these very, you know, extreme magical insertions into our so-called science. Things like the Big Bang and stuff. I mean,
Well, they used to do that in ancient religion all the time, didn't it?
Right, sure.
It's like just human nature.
Right, but just see, I'm just trying to get you to understand that, you know, that technically why it's not because they want to introduce magic. There's no way, you know, you have to introduce magic when you don't know the real evolutionary process. And so you have to embody that whole real evolutionary process that you don't know about into a magical starting point.
Finger snap.
Right? And so it's just inescapable that the only way to rationalize things when you don't know what you can't observe is you have to introduce a magical beginning into your stories. You know, like the story of the evolution of the universe that we currently have. And, you know, in that story, it's in the beginning was the magical, you know, out of nothing comes something. You know, that is the Big Bang. You know, and you have it magically make the things that we've just gotten to here, basically. Instead of having a whole long process before that, instead of a magic finger snap. Now, and it just kind of continues in that way. You know, we have the idea that out of a cloud of gas, you know, in just effectively a magic finger snap, you make the sun and the whole solar system. Okay, you know,
in 7 days.
Yeah, and this. Well, no. Well, I mean, the difference between 7 days and, you know, and the geology story is a difference of no consequence. Okay, right. But it just it won't be hundreds of billions of years when we get to that. Okay, but this story just keeps repeating. You have hundreds of billions of years that we have involved in a magic finger snap, and then, you know, we have a subsequent story where billions of years get condensed into a magic, you know, finger snap, and it's like a fractal thing. See, the story just keeps repeating on smaller and smaller scales as we go forward, you know, because you don't know the real evolutionary precursors, and so you have to just somehow convince yourself that it all just kind of zippity zip comes together in some way. Yep.
So if we are getting usable answers now, why is it that we need to care about having, you know, why do we need to know about reality?
Yeah, so it boils down to that. I mean, why are these so-called scientists not, why are they satisfied? Let's say it that way. Yeah, see, and you've got to want.
Don had the answer.
No, that's not the main answer. Tenure. It's not tenure. You've got to want, you know, a logical reality. I mean, if all you want is the correct answer, you don't need science. You just need rationalization.
You can make that up.
Okay, science is about getting, not about getting, you know, an answer. It's about getting that answer in a true context. Right? You have to be curious about reality. as opposed to just pleased with appearance and your ability to rationalize appearance. See, a fancy animal is content with rationalization of appearance. A human is not.
It's supposed to be.
A human is not. A human is curious. A human wants to know what the reality is behind appearance. Right? See, so again, I mean, it's harsh, but it's true. It's sad to record that so few persons on your ranch, and that includes all these so-called scientists, right? They're not really availing themselves of their human nature in any full fashion. Or they wouldn't be satisfied with just rationalizing the appearance. They would want to be a scientist. They would want to be trying to figure out what the reality is behind the appearances. Right? You know, they don't want to just have a how that gets the answer. They want to know the why behind the answer. You know, you've got to be humanly curious.
You know, you laugh about tenure. That is, as a joke, it's very funny. There's probably some truth to it. But on the other hand, for a scientist, really courageous young scientist or group of scientists who see the flaw in these assumptions, these magical assumptions that were made, whatever, but to come forth and challenge their entire industry and their futures, and they have to live. It's just without revelation, and I don't think.
Well, and again, the point is not to alter the main evolutionary stream. Right? This is here for those who want to pull themselves out of that evolutionary stream, so they don't have to worry about fitting into that evolutionary stream and getting tenure. They're willing to courageously step out of the stream and stand as a rugged individual, right? Because they don't want to just conform with the current state of evolution on this planet, you know, in the material comfort era. They want to stand apart and they want to know the truth, right? The same goes for religionists, right? You can do lots of so-called religious things that conform with the current bulk of the evolutionary stream, you know. And fundamentally, the world doesn't just need another one of those; it's got plenty already, right? But what it doesn't have is genuine religionists who know that religion is not fundamentally a group phenomenon; it's an individual phenomenon. The Universal Father can't relate to a group. He can only relate to an individual. Right? Again, see, just the inherent courageous and independent cosmic thinking. It takes that to be a genuine religionist. You know, it starts as an individual fact. And fundamentally, a scientist does too, see? A scientist doesn't start as someone who's part of a faculty. A scientist is an individual, because as a human, you are fundamentally an individual. Your personality is absolutely unique. It stands as an island universe inherently. You know, that's the starting point. You have to have the courage to start alone, and then associate. Now, and not think that somehow you can just be part of an amorphous pool and have some sort of individual meaning to your existence. Right? Meaning comes from relating your absolutely separate thingness to value. If you're not individuated first, there's no meaning possible. Right? You can see, I mean, you start talking about the truth of what we're reading about here, and things and beings are in the same space. It doesn't matter if you're talking about nebulae or humans.
And you read this.
There's some fundamental truths.
Realize that there's some, you know, new local universes that haven't even found the space for them yet out there. Right. So there's a long ways before, you know, the Supreme is going to manifest totally in our...
It's only been in play for 300 trillion years. It's just getting started.
Exactly.
Be patient already.
A long time to go yet, right? Okay, all right. So we'll continue on with this. We'll actually see. We'll get some spiral stuff happening here next time. But I mean, just notice that even as rudimentary as this, look how we easily spent 2 hours just talking about this rudimentary stuff. There's a lot here, right? Okay, so
we covered 235 billion.
Yeah, we did spend a few. Yep. Okay, let's take a moment here, everyone.